hacked out here to the Willy Wags just for shits and giggles, so listen to me now. Are you listening? Sure. Once this show is scheduled, and it will be, you're going to do what any artist new on the scene would be expected to do. Publicity, interviews, starting with Mary Iyer, and going on from there to the newspapers and Channel 6. If they want to play up your missing arm, so much the better. He did the framing thing with his hands again. Edgar Fremantle bursts on the Suncoast art scene like a phoenix from the smoking ashes of tragedy. Smoke this, amigo, I said, and gripped my crotch. But I couldn't help smiling. Wireman took no notice of my vulgarity. He was on a roll. That missing brazo of yours is going to be golden. Wireman, you are one cynical mongrel. He took this for the compliment it sort of was. He nodded and waved it aside magnanimously. I'll serve as your lawyer. You're going to pick the paintings. Nanuzzi consults. Nanuzzi sets the show arrangement. You consult. Sound about right?
I guess so, yeah, if that's how it's done.
It's how this is going to be done. And Edgar, last but very far from least, you're going to call everyone you care for and invite them to your show. But, yes, he said, nodding, everyone. Your shrink, your ex, both daughters, this guy Tom Riley, the woman who rehabbed you. Kathy Green, I said, bemused. Wireman, Tom won't come. No way in hell. Neither will Pam, and Lynn's in France, with Strap, for God's sake. Wireman took no notice. You mentioned a lawyer. William Bozeman III. Bozy. Invite him. Oh, your mom and dad, of course. Your sisters and brothers. My parents are dead, and I was an only child. Bozy. I nodded. Bozy would come. But don't call him that, Wireman. Not to his face. Call another lawyer Bozy? Do you think I'm stupid? He considered. I shot myself in the head and didn't manage to kill myself, so you better not answer that. I wasn't paying much attention because I was thinking. For the first time, I understood that I could throw a coming-out party for my other life, and people might show up. The idea was both thrilling and daunting. They might all come, you know. Your ex, your globe-trotting daughter, and your suicidal accountant. Think of it. A mob of Michiganders. Minnesotans. He shrugged and flipped up his hands, indicating they were both the same to him. Pretty snooty for a guy from Nebraska. I could charter a plane, I said. A Gulfstream. Take a whole floor at the Ritz-Carlton. Blow a big wad. Why the fuck not? That's right, he said and snickered. Really do the starving artist bit. Yeah, I said. Put out a sign in the window. We'll work for truffles. Then we were both laughing. 9. After our plates and glasses were in the dishwasher, I led him back upstairs, but just long enough so I could take half a dozen digital photos of him. Big, charmless close-ups. I've taken a few good photographs in my life, but always by accident. I hate cameras, and the camera seemed to know it. When I was done, I told him he could go home and spell Anne-Marie. It was dark outside, and I offered him my Malibu. Gonna walk. The air'll be good for me. Then he pointed at the canvas. Can I take a look? Actually, I'd rather you didn't. I thought he might protest, but he just nodded and went back downstairs, almost trotting. There was a new spring in his step. That was surely not my imagination. At the door, he said, call Nanuzzi in the morning. Don't let the grass grow under your heels. All right. And you call me if anything changes with your... I gestured at his face with my paint-stippled hand. He grinned. You'll be the first to know. For the time being, I can settle for being headache-free. The grin faded. Are you sure it won't come back? I'm sure of nothing. Yeah. Yeah, that's the human condition, ain't it? But I thank you for trying. And before I knew he was going to do it, he had taken my hand and kissed the back of it. A gentle kiss in spite of the bristles on his upper lip. Then he told me adios and was gone into the dark, and the only sound was the sigh of the gulf and the whispering conversation of the shells under the house. Then there was another sound. The phone was ringing. 10. It was Ilse, calling to chat. Yes, her classes were going fine. Yes, she felt well. Great, in fact. Yes, she was calling her mother once a week and staying in touch with Lynn by email. In Ilse's opinion, Lynn's strep was probably so much self-diagnosed bullcrap. I told her I was stunned by her generosity of feeling, and she laughed. I told her there was a possibility that I might be showing my work at a gallery in Sarasota, and she shrieked so loudly I had to hold the phone away from my ear. Daddy, that's wonderful. When? Can I come?
Sure, if you want to, I said.
I'm going to invite everybody.
This was a decision I hadn't entirely made until I heard myself telling her.
We're thinking mid-April.
Shit. That's when I was planning to catch up with the Hummingbirds tour.
She paused, thinking, then, I can work them both in. A little tour of my own.
You think?
Yes, of course. You just give me the date and I am there. Tears pricked the back of my eyelids. I don't know what it's like to have sons, but I'm sure it can't be as rewarding, as plain nice, as having daughters.
I appreciate that, hon. Do you think, is there any possibility your sister might come?
You know what? I think she will, Ilse said. She'll be crazy to see what you're doing that's got people in the know so excited. Will you get written up?
My friend Wireman thinks so. One-armed artists and all that.
But you're just good, Daddy.
I thanked her, then moved on to Carson Jones, asked what she'd heard from him.
He's fine, she said.
Really?
Sure. Why?
I don't know. I just thought I heard a little cloud in your voice. She laughed ruefully. You know me too well. The fact is they're SRO every place they play now. Word's getting around. The tour was supposed to end on May 15th because four of the singers have other commitments, but the booking agent found three new ones. And Bridget Andreasen, who's become quite the star, got them to push back the start of her understudy pastorate in Arizona, which was lucky. Her voice flattened as she said this last, and became the voice of some adult woman I didn't know. So instead of finishing in mid-May, the tour has been extended to the end of June, with dates in the Midwest and a final concert at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. Some big a time, huh? This was my phrase, used when Illy and Lynn were little girls putting on what they called ballet super shows in the garage. But I couldn't recall ever saying it in that sad tone of not quite sarcasm.
Are you worried about your guy and this Bridget?
No,
she said at once and laughed. He says she has a great voice, and he's lucky to be singing with her. They have two songs now instead of just one, but she's shallow and stuck up. Also, he wishes she'd pop some certs before he has to, you know, share a mic with her. I waited.
Okay, Ilse said at last.
Okay, what?
Okay, I'm worried.
A pause.
A little bit.
Because he's with her on a bus every day and on stage with her every night, and I'm here.
Another long pause, then.
And he doesn't sound the same when I talk to him on the phone. Almost, but not quite.
That could be your imagination.
Yes, it could. And in any case, if something's going on, nothing is. I'm sure nothing is. But if something is, better now rather than after, you know, after we...
Yes, I said, thinking that was so adult it hurt.
I remembered finding the picture of them at the roadside stand with their arms around each other, and touching it with my missing right hand, then rushing up to Little Pink with Reba clamped between my stump and my right side. A long time ago, that seemed. I love you, Punkin, Smiley had written. But the picture I'd done that day with my Venus-colored pencils, they also seemed a long time ago, had somehow mocked the idea of enduring love. The little girl in her little tennis dress, looking out at the enormous gulf, tennis balls all around her feet, more floating in on the incoming waves. That girl had been Reba, but also Ilse, and who else? Elizabeth Eastlake? The idea came out of nowhere, but I thought, yes. The water runs faster now, Elizabeth had said. Soon come the rapids. Do you feel that?
I felt it.
Daddy, are you there?
Yes, I said again.
Honey, be good to yourself, okay? And try not to get too spun up. My friend down here says in the end, we wear out our worries.
I sort of believe that. You always make me feel better, she said. That's why I call. I love you, Daddy. I love you, too. How many bunches? How many years since she'd asked that? 12, 14? It didn't matter. I remembered the answer. 1,000,001 for under your pillow, I said. Then I said goodbye and hung up and thought that if Carson Jones hurt my daughter, I'd kill him. The thought made me smile a little, wondering how many fathers had the same thought and made the same promise. But of all those fathers, I might be the only one who could kill a heedless, daughter-hurting suitor with a few strokes of a paintbrush. 11. Dario Nannuzzi and one of his partners, Jimmy Yoshida, came out the very next day. Yoshida was a Japanese-American Dorian Gray. Getting out of Nannuzzi's Jaguar in my driveway, dressed in faded straight-leg jeans and an even more faded T-shirt, long black hair blowing in the breeze off the gulf, he looked 18. By the time he got to the end of the walk, he looked 28. When he shook my hand, up close and personal, I could see the lines tattooed around his eyes and mouth, and put him somewhere in his late 40s. "Pleased to meet you," he said. "The gallery is still buzzing over your visit. Mary Iyer has been back 3 times to ask when we're going to sign you up." "Come on in," I said. "Our friend down the beach, Wireman, has called me 2 times already to make sure I don't sign anything without him." Nannuzzi smiled. "We're not in the business of cheating artists, Mr. Fremantle. Edgar, remember? Would you like some coffee?" "Look first," Jimmy Yoshida said. "Coffee later." I took a breath. "Fine. Come on upstairs." 12. I'd covered my portrait of Wireman, which was still a little more than a vague shape with a brain floating in it 3/4 of the way up. And my picture of Tina Garibaldi and Candy Brown had gone bye-bye in the downstairs closet, along with Friends with Benefits and the red robe figure. But I had left my other stuff out. There was now enough to lean against 2 walls and part of a 3rd, 41 canvases in all, including 5 versions of Girl and Ship. When their silence was more than I could bear, I broke it. "Thanks for the tip on that liquid stuff. It's great. What my daughters would call de bomb." Nannuzzi seemed not to have heard. He was going in one direction, Yoshida in the other. Neither asked about the big, sheet-draped canvas on the easel. I guessed that doing that might be considered poor etiquette in their world. Beneath us, the shells murmured. Somewhere, far off, a jet ski blatted. My right arm itched, but faint and very deep, telling me it wanted to paint but could wait. It knew the time would come. Before the sun went down. I'd paint, and at first, I would consult the photographs clipped to the sides of the easel, and then something else would take over, and the shells would grind louder, and the chrome of the gulf would change color first to peach, and then to pink, and then to orange, and finally to red. And it would be well. It would be well. All manner of things would be well. Nannuzzi and Yoshida met back by the stairs leading down from Little Pink. They conferred briefly, then came toward me. From the hip pocket of his jeans, Yoshida produced a business-size envelope with the words Sample Contract Skoto Gallery, neatly typed on the front. "Here," he said. "Tell Mr. Wireman we'll make any reasonable accommodation in order to represent your work." "Really?" I asked. "Are you sure?" Yoshida didn't smile. "Yes, Edgar. We're sure." "Thank you," I said. "Thank you both." I looked past Yoshida to Nannuzzi, who was smiling. "Dario, I really appreciate this." Dario looked around at the paintings, gave a little laugh, then lifted his hands and dropped them. "I think we should be the ones expressing appreciation, Edgar." "I'm impressed by their clarity," Yoshida said, "and their, I don't know, but I think lucidity. These images carry the viewer along without drowning him. The other thing that amazes me is how fast you've worked your unbottling." "I don't know that word."
"Artists who begin late are sometimes said to unbottle," Nannuzzi said. "It's as if they're trying to make up for lost time. Still, 40 paintings in a matter of months, of weeks, really."
"And you didn't even see the one that killed the child murderer," I thought.
Dario laughed without much humor. Try not to let the place burn down, all right?
Yes, that would be bad. Assuming we make a deal, could I store some of my work at your gallery?
Of course, Nannuzzi said.
That's great. Thinking I'd like to sign as soon as possible, no matter what Wireman thought of the contract, just to get these pictures off the key. And it wasn't fire I was worried about. Unbottling might be fairly common among artists who began later in life, but 41 paintings on Duma Key were at least 36 too many. I could feel their live presence in this room, like electricity in a bell jar. Of course, Dario and Jimmy felt it, too. That was part of what made those fucking pictures so effective. They were catching. 13. I joined Wireman and Elizabeth for coffee at the end of El Palacio's boardwalk the next morning. I was down to nothing but aspirin to get going, and my great beach walks were now a pleasure instead of a challenge, especially since the weather had warmed up. Elizabeth was in her wheelchair, with the remains of a breakfast pastry scattered across her tray. It looked to me as if he'd also managed to get some juice and a half cup of coffee into her. She was staring out at the gulf with an expression of stern disapproval, looking this morning more like Captain Bligh of HMS Bounty than a mafia don's daughter.
Buenos dias, mi amigo, Wireman said, and to Elizabeth, it's Edgar, Miss Eastlake. He came for sevens. Want to say hello?
Piss shit head rat, she said.
I think. In any case, she said it to the gulf, which was still dark blue and mostly asleep. Still not so good, I take it, I said.
No, she's gone down before and come back up, but she's never gone down so far.
I still haven't brought her any of my pictures to look at.
No point right now.
He handed me a cup of black coffee.
Here, get your bad self around this.
I passed him the envelope with the sample contract in it. As Wireman pulled it out, I turned to Elizabeth.
Would you like some poems later today? I asked her.
Nothing.
She looked only out at the gulf with that stony frown. Captain Bligh about to order someone strapped to the foremast and flogged raw. For no reason at all, I asked, was your father a skin diver, Elizabeth?
She turned her head slightly and cut her ancient eyes in my direction. Her upper lip lifted in a dog's grin. There was a moment, it was brief, but seemed long, when I felt another person looking at me. Or not a person at all, an entity that was wearing Elizabeth Eastlake's old, doughy body like a sock. My right hand clenched briefly, and once more I felt non-existent, two long fingernails bite into a non-existent palm. Then she looked back at the gulf, simultaneously feeling across the tray until her fingers happened on a piece of the breakfast pastry, and I was calling myself an idiot who had to stop letting his nerves get the best of him. There were undoubtedly strange forces at work here, but not every shadow was a ghost.
He was, Wireman said absently, unfolding the contract. John Eastlake was a regular Recall Browning. You know, the guy who played the creature from the Black Lagoon back in the '50s.
Wireman, you're an artesian well of useless information.
Yeah, ain't I cool? Her old man didn't buy that harpoon pistol in a store, you know. Miss Eastlake says he had it commissioned. It probably ought to be in a museum.
But I didn't care about John Eastlake's harpoon gun. Not just then.
Are you reading that contract?
He dropped it on the tray and looked at me, bemused.
I was trying.
And your left eye?
Nothing. But hey, no reason to be disappointed. The doctor said,
do me a favor, cover your left peeper. He did.
What do you see?
You, Edgar. Un hombre muy feo.
Yeah, cover the right one. He did.
Now I just see black. Only,
he paused.
Maybe not as black.
He dropped his hand again.
I can't tell for sure. These days I can't separate the truth from wishful thinking.
He shook his head hard enough to make his hair fly, then thumped his forehead with the heel of his hand.
Take it easy. Easy for you to say.
He sat silent for a few moments, then picked the piece of breakfast pastry out of Elizabeth's hand and fed it to her. When it was tucked safely away in her mouth, he turned to me.
Would you mind her while I go get something?
Happy to.
He jogged up the boardwalk and I was left with Elizabeth. I tried feeding her one of the remaining pieces of breakfast pastry and she nibbled it out of my hand, bringing back a fleeting recollection of a rabbit I'd had when I was 7 or 8. Mr. Hitchens had been its name, although I no longer knew why. Memory's a funny thing, isn't it? Her lips were toothless and soft, but not unpleasant. I stroked the side of her head, where her white hair, wiry, rather coarse, was pulled back toward a bun. It occurred to me that Wireman must comb that hair each morning and make that bun. That Wireman must have dressed her this morning, including diapers, for surely she wasn't continent when she was like this. I wondered if he thought of Esmeralda when he pinned the pins or secured the ties. I wondered if he thought of Julia when he made the bun. I picked up another piece of breakfast pastry. She opened her mouth obediently for it, but I hesitated. "What's in the red picnic basket, Elizabeth? The one in the attic?" She seemed to think, and hard. Then, "Any old pipe dip." She hesitated, shrugged. "Any old pipe dip Addie wants. Shoot!" and cackled. It was a startling witch-like sound. I fed her the rest of her breakfast pastry, piece by piece, and asked no more questions. 14. When Wireman returned, he had a micro-cassette recorder. He handed it to me. "I hate to ask you to put that contract on tape, but I have to. At least the damn thing's only 2 pages long. I'd like it back this afternoon, if that's possible." "It is. And if some of my pictures actually sell, you're on commission, my friend. 15%. That should cover both legal and talent." He sat back in his chair, laughing and groaning at the same time. "Por Dios. Just when I thought I couldn't sink any lower in life, I become a fucking talent agent. Excuse the language, Miss Eastlake." She took no notice, only stared sternly out at the gulf where, at the farthest, bluest edge of vision, a tanker was dreaming north toward Tampa. It fascinated me at once. Boats on the gulf had a way of doing that to me. Then I forced my attention back to Wireman. "You're responsible for all this, so..." "Bullshit, you say. So you have to be prepared to stand up and take your cut like a man. I'll take 10%. And that's probably too much. Take it, muchacho, or we start discussing 8. "All right, 10 it is." I stuck out my hand, and we shook over Elizabeth's crumb-littered tray. I put the little recorder in my pocket. "And you'll let me know if there's any change in your..." I pointed at his red eye, which really wasn't as red as it had been. "Of course." He picked up the contract. There were crumbs on it from Elizabeth's pastry. He brushed them off and handed it to me. Then he leaned forward, hands clasped between his knees, gazing at me over the imposing shelf of Elizabeth's bosom. "If I had another X-ray, what would it show? That the slug was smaller? That it was gone?"
"I don't know."
"Are you still working on my portrait?"
"Yes."
"Don't stop, muchacho. Please don't stop."
"I don't plan to. But don't get your hopes up too high, okay?"
"I won't." Then another thought struck him, one that was eerily similar to Dario's stated concern. "What do you think would happen if lightning struck Big Pink and it burned flat with that picture inside? What do you think would happen to me?"
I shook my head. I didn't want to think about it. I did think about asking Wireman if I could go up to El Palacio's attic and look around for a certain picnic basket. It was red. Then decided not to. I was sure it was there, less sure that I wanted to know what was in it. There were strange things kicking around Duma Key, and I had reason to believe they weren't all nice things, and what I wanted to do about most of them was nothing. If I left them alone, then maybe they'd leave me alone. I'd send most of my pictures off-island to keep everything nice and peaceful, sell them too if people wanted to buy them. I could watch them go without a pang. I was passionate about them while I was working on them, but when they were done, they meant no more to me than the hard semicircles of callus I'd sometimes sand off the sides of my great toes so my work boots wouldn't pinch at the end of a hot August day on some job site. I'd hold back the Girl and Ship series, not out of any special affection, but
but because the series wasn't done, those paintings were still live flesh. I might show them and sell them later, but for now I meant to keep them right where they were in Little Pink. 15. There were no boats on the horizon by the time I got back to my place, and the urge to paint had passed for the time being. I used Wireman's micro recorder instead, and put the sample contract on tape. I was no lawyer, but I'd seen and signed my share of legal paper in my other life, and this struck me as pretty simple. That evening I took both the contract and the tape recorder back down to El Palacio. Wireman was making supper. Elizabeth was sitting in the china parlor. The gimlet-eyed heron, which was a kind of unofficial house pet, stood on the walk outside, peering in with grim disapproval. The late-day sun filled the room with light. Yet it was not light. Chinatown was in disarray, the people and animals tumbled here and there, the buildings scattered to the four corners of the bamboo table. The pillared plantation house was actually overturned. In her chair beside it, wearing her Captain Bligh expression, Elizabeth seemed to dare me to put things right. Wireman spoke from behind me, making me jump. If I try to set things back up in any kind of pattern, she sweeps it apart again. She's knocked a bunch to the floor and broken them. Are they valuable? Some, but that's really not the point. When she's herself, she knows every one of them, knows and loves. If she comes around and asks where Bo Peep is, or the coaling man, and I have to tell her she broke them, she'll be sad all day. If she comes around. Yes, well. Think I'll head on home, Wireman. Gonna paint? That's the plan. I turned to the disarray on the table. Wireman. Right here, Bato. Why does she mess them up when she's like this? I think because she can't stand looking at what she's not. I started to turn around. He put a hand on my shoulder. I just assumed you didn't look at me just now, he said. His voice was barely under control. I'm not myself just now. Go out the front door and then cut back through the courtyard if you want to take the beach. Would you do that? I did that. And when I got back, I worked on his portrait. It was all right. By which I suppose I mean it was good. I could see his face in there wanting to come out, starting to rise. There was nothing special, but that was fine. It was always best when it was nothing special. I was happy. I remembered that. I was at peace. The shells murmured. My right arm itched, but very low and deep. The window giving on the gulf was a rectangle of blackness. Once I went downstairs and ate a sandwich, I turned on the radio and found The Bone. Jay Giles doing Hold Your Lovin'. Jay Giles was nothing special. Only great. A gift from the gods of rock and roll. I painted and Wireman's face rose a little more. It was a ghost now. It was a ghost haunting the canvas. But it was a harmless ghost. If I turned round, Wireman wouldn't be standing at the head of the stairs where Tom Riley had been standing. And down the beach at El Palacio de Asesinos, the left side of Wireman's world was still dark. It was just a thing I knew. I painted. The radio played. Below the music, the shells whispered. At some point I quit, showered, and went to bed. There were no dreams. When I think back to my time on Duma Key, those days in February and March when I was working on Wireman's portrait seem like the best days. 16. Wireman called the next day at 10. I was already at my easel. Am I interrupting? It's okay, I said. I can use a break. This was a lie. We missed you this morning. A pause. Well, you know, I missed you. She... Yeah, I said. The contract's a bunny hug. Very little to fuck with. It says you and the gallery split right down the middle, but I'm going to cap that. 50-50 shall not live after gross sales reach a quarter mil. Once you pass that point, the split goes to 60-40, your favor. Wireman, I'll never sell a quarter of $1 million worth of paintings.
I'm hoping they'll feel exactly the same way, muchacho, which is why I'm also going to propose that the split goes to 70-30 at half a million. Plus a hand job from Miss Florida, I said feebly. Get that in there.
Noted.
The other thing is this 180-day termination clause. It ought to be 90. I don't foresee a problem there, but I think it's interesting. They're afraid some big New York gallery is going to swoop down and carry you off. Anything else about the contract I should know? Nope, and I sense you want to get back to work. I'll get in touch with Mr. Yoshida about these changes.
Any change in your vision?
No, amigo. Wish I could say there was. But you keep painting.
I was taking the phone away from my ear when he said, "Did you happen to see the news this morning?"
No, never turned it on. Why? County coroner says Candy Brown died of congestive heart failure. Just thought you'd like to know.
17. I painted. It was a slow go, but far from a no-go. Wireman swam into existence around the window where his brain swam on the gulf. It was a younger Wireman than the one in the photos clipped to the sides of my easel, but that was okay. I consulted them less and less, and on the third day I took them down altogether. I didn't need them anymore. Still, I painted the way I supposed most other artists painted, as if it were a job instead of some speed trip insanity that came and went in spasms. I did it with the radio on, now always tuned to the bone. On the fourth day, Wireman brought me a revised contract and told me I could sign. He said Nannuzzi wanted to photograph my paintings and make slides for a lecture at the Selby Library in Sarasota in mid-March, a month before my show opened. The lecture, Wireman said, would be attended by 60 or 70 art patrons from the Tampa-Sarasota area. I told him fine and signed the contract. Dario came out that afternoon. I was impatient for him to click his pics and be gone so I could go back to work. Mostly to make conversation, I asked him who would be giving the lecture at the Selby Library. Dario looked at me with one eyebrow cocked, as if I had made a joke. "The one person in the world who is now conversant with your work," he said.
"You."
I gaped at him. "I can't give a lecture. I don't know anything about art." He swept his arm at the paintings, which Jack and two part-timers from the Skodo were going to crate and transport to Sarasota the following week. They would remain crated, I assumed, in the storage area at the back of the gallery until just before the show opened.
"These say different, my friend."
"Dario, these people know stuff. They've taken courses. I'll bet most of them were art majors, for Christ's sake. What do you want me to do, stand up there and say, duh?"
"That's pretty much what Jackson Pollock did when he talked about his work, often while drunk.
And it made him rich."
Dario came over and took me by the stump. That impressed me. Very few people will touch the stump of a limb. It's as if they believe down deep that amputation might be catching.
"Listen, my friend, these are important people. Not just because they have money, but because they are interested in new artists, and each one knows three more who feel the same. After the lecture, your lecture, the talk will start. The kind of talk that almost always turns into that magical thing called buzz."
He paused, twiddling the strap of his camera and smiling a little.
"All you have to do is talk about how you began, how you grew."
"Dario, I don't know how I grew."
"Then say that. Say anything. You're an artist, for God's sake."
I left it at that. The threatened lecture still seemed distant to me, and I wanted him out of there. I wanted to turn on the bone, pull the cloth off the painting on the easel, and go back to work on Wireman Looks West. Want the dirty-ass truth? The painting was no longer about some hypothetical magic trick. Now it was its own magic trick. I'd become very selfish about it, and anything that might come after. A promised interview with Mary Eyre, the lecture, the show itself, seemed to be not ahead of me, but somehow far above me, the way rain on the surface of the gulf must seem to a fish. During that first week of March, it was all about daylight. Not sunset light, but daylight. How it filled Little Pink and seemed to lift it. That week it was about the music from the radio. Anything by the Allman Brothers, Molly Hatchet, Foghat. It was about J.J. Cale beginning Call Me the Breeze by saying,
Here's another of your old rock and roll favorites, Shuffle On Down to Broadway. And how when I turned the radio off and cleaned my brushes, I could hear the shells under the house. It was about the ghost face I saw, the one belonging to a younger man who had yet to see the view from Duma. There was a song, I think by Paul Simon, with the line, "If I'd never loved, I never would have cried." That was this face. It wasn't a real face, not quite real, but I was making it real. It was growing around the brain that was floating on the gulf. I didn't need photographs anymore, because this was a face I knew. This one was a memory. 18. March 4th was hot all day, but I didn't bother turning on the air conditioning. I painted in nothing but a pair of gym shorts, with the sweat trickling down my face and sides. The telephone rang twice. The first time it was Wireman. "We haven't seen much of you in these parts lately, Edgar. Come to supper?" "I think I'm going to pass, Wireman. Thanks." "Painting or tired of our society down here at El Palacio? Or both?" "Just the painting part. I'm almost done. Any change in the vision department?" "The left lamp is still out, but I bought an eye patch for it. And when I wear it, I can read with my right eye for as long as 15 minutes at a stretch. This is a great leap forward, and I think I owe it to you." "I don't know if you do or not," I said. "This isn't the same as the picture I did of Candy Brown and Tina Garibaldi, or of my wife and her friends, for that matter. This time there's no bam. You know what I mean when I say bam?" "Yes, muchacho. But if something's going to happen, I think it'll happen soon. If not, you'll at least have a portrait of how you looked. Maybe how you looked when you were 25. "Are you kidding, amigo?" "No. I don't even think I remember what I looked like when I was 25. How's Elizabeth? Any change in her?" He sighed. "She seemed a little better yesterday morning, so I set her up in the back parlor. There's a smaller table there, what I call the China suburbs, and she threw a set of Wallendorf ballerinas on the floor, smashed all 8. Irreplaceable, of course." "I'm sorry. Last fall, I never thought it could get this bad, and God punishes us for what we can't imagine." My second call came 15 minutes later, and I threw my brush down on my work table in exasperation. It was Jimmy Yoshida. It was hard to stay exasperated after being exposed to his excitement, which bordered on exuberance. He'd seen the slides, which he claimed were going to knock everyone on their asses. "That's wonderful," I said. "At my lecture, I intend to tell them, get up off your asses, and then walk out." He laughed as though this were the funniest thing he'd ever heard, then said, "Mainly I call to ask if there are any pictures you want to mark NFS, not for sale." Outside, there was a rumble that sounded like a big, heavily loaded truck crossing a plank bridge. I looked toward the gulf, where there were no plank bridges, and realized I'd heard thunder far off to the west. "Edgar, are you still there?" "Still here," I said. "Assuming anyone wants to buy, you can sell everything but the Girl and Ship series." "Ah." That sounded like a disappointed ah. "I was hoping to buy one of those for the gallery. I had my eye on number 2. And considering the terms of the contract, he would have been buying it at a 50% discount. "Not bad, lad," my father might have said. "That series isn't done yet. Maybe when the rest of them are painted." "How many more will there be?" "I'll keep painting them until I can read the fucking ghost ship's name on the transom." I might have said this aloud if more thunder hadn't rumbled out in the west. "I guess I'll know when the time comes. Now, if you'll excuse me." "You're working, sorry. I'll let you get back to it." When I killed the cordless, I considered whether or not I did want to go back to work. But I was close. If I forged ahead, I might be able to finish tonight. And I sort of liked the idea of painting while a thunderstorm blew in from the gulf. God help me, the idea struck me as romantic. So I turned up the radio, which I'd turned down to talk on the phone, and there was Axl Rose screaming ever deeper into "Welcome to the Jungle." I picked up a brush and put it behind my ear. Then I picked up another and began to paint. 19. The thunderheads stacked up,
Huge flat boats, black on the bottom and bruised purple through the middle. Every now and then lightning would flash inside them, and then they looked like brains filled with bad ideas. The gulf lost its color and went dead. Sunset was a yellow band that flicked feeble orange and went out. Little pink filled with gloom. The radio began to bray static with each burst of lightning. I paused long enough to turn it off, but I didn't turn on the lights. I don't remember exactly when it stopped being me that was doing the painting, and to this day I'm not sure that it ever stopped being me, maybe see, maybe no. All I know is that at some point I looked down and saw my right arm in the last of the failing daylight and the occasional stutters of lightning. The stump was tanned, the rest dead white. The muscles hung loose and flabby. There was no scar, no seam, except the tan line, but below there itched like old dry fire. Then the lightning flashed again, and there was no arm. There had never been an arm, not on Duma Key at least. But the itch was still there, so bad it made you want to bite a piece out of something. I turned back to the canvas, and the second I did, the itch poured in that direction, like water let out of a bag, and the frenzy fell on me. The storm dropped on the key as the dark came down, and I thought of certain circus acts where the guy throws knives blindfolded at a pretty girl spread-eagled on a spinning wooden platter. And I think I laughed because I was painting blindfolded. Or almost. Every now and then the lightning would flash and wiremen would leap at me. Wiremen at 25. Wiremen before Julia, before Esmeralda, before La Loteria. I win, you win. A huge flash of lightning lit my window purple-white, and a great whooping gust of gale rode that electricity in from the gulf, driving rain against the glass so hard I thought, in the part of my mind still capable of thought, that it must surely break. A munitions dump exploded directly overhead, and beneath me the murmur of the shells had become the gossip of dead things telling secrets in bone voices. How could I not have heard that before? Dead things, yes. A ship had come here. A ship of the dead with rotted sails, and it had offloaded living corpses. They were under this house, and the storm had brought them to life. I could see them pushing up through the boneyard blanket of the shells, pallid jellies with green hair and seagull eyes, crawling over each other in the dark and talking, 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 yes, because they had a lot to catch up on. And who knew when the next storm might come and bring them to life again? Yet I still painted. I did it in terror. And in the dark, my arm moving up and down so that for a little while there, I seemed to actually be conducting the storm. I couldn't have stopped. And at some point, Wireman Looks West was done. My right arm told me so. I slashed my initials in the lower left corner, and then broke the brush in two, using both hands to do it. The pieces I dropped on the floor. I staggered away from my easel, crying out for whatever was going on to stop. And it would, surely it would. The picture was done, and surely now it would. I came to the head of the stairs and looked down, and there at the bottom were two small dripping figures. I thought, apple, orange. I thought, I win, you win. Then the lightning flashed, and I saw two girls of about six, surely twins, and surely Elizabeth Eastlake's drowned sisters. They wore dresses that were plastered to their bodies. Their hair was plastered to their cheeks. Their faces were pale horrors. I knew where they had come from. They had crawled out of the shells. They started up the stairs toward me, hand in hand. Thunder exploded a mile overhead. I tried to scream. I couldn't. I thought, I am not seeing this. I thought, I am. I can do this, one of the girls said. She spoke in the voice of the shells. It was red. The other girl said. She spoke in the voice of the shells. They were halfway up now. Their heads were little more than skulls with wet hair draggling down the sides. Sit in the char, they said together, like girls chanting a skip rope rhyme. But they spoke in the voice of the shells. Sit in the burn. They reached up for me with terrible fish belly fingers. I fainted at the head of the stairs. 20. The telephone was ringing. That was my telephone winter. I opened my eyes and groped for the bedside lamp, wanting light right away because I'd just had the worst nightmare of my life. Instead of finding the lamp, my fingers struck a wall. At the moment they did, I became aware that my head was cocked at a strange, painful angle against that same wall. Thunder rumbled, but faint and sullen. It was going away thunder now, and that was enough to bring everything back with painful, frightening clarity. I wasn't in bed. I was in Little Pink. I had fainted because my eyes flew open. My ass was on the landing, my legs trailing down the stairs. I thought of the two drowned girls. No, it was more. It was an instant of total, brilliant recall, and I shot to my feet without feeling my bad hip at all. My concentration was fixed entirely on the three light switches at the head of the stairs, but even as my fingers found them, I thought, won't work, the storm will have knocked out the power. But they did work, banishing the dark in the studio and the stairwell. I had a nasty moment when I saw sand and water at the foot of the stairs, but the light reached far enough for me to see that the front door had blown open. Surely it had just blown open. In the living room, the phone quit and the answering machine kicked in. My recorded voice invited the caller to leave a message at the sound of the beep. The caller was Wireman. Edgar, where are you? I was too disoriented to tell if I was hearing excitement, dismay, or terror in his voice. Call me. You need to call me right away. Then a click. I went downstairs one tentative step at a time like a man in his 80s and made the lights my first priority. Living room, kitchen, both bedrooms, Florida room. I even turned on the lights in the bathrooms, reaching into the darkness to do it, bracing myself in case something cold and wet and draped in seaweed should reach back. Nothing did. With all the lights on, I relaxed enough to realize I was hungry again, starving. It was the only time I felt that way after working on Wireman's portrait. But of course, that last session had been a lulu. I stooped to examine the mess that had blown in through the open door. Just sand and water. The water already beating atop the wax my housekeeper used to keep the cypress gleaming. There was some dampness on the lower stair risers, which were carpeted, but dampness was all it was. I wouldn't admit to myself that I'd been looking for footprints. I went to the kitchen, made a chicken sandwich, and gobbled it standing at the counter. I grabbed a beer from the fridge to wash it down. When the sandwich was gone, I ate the remains of the previous day's salad, more or less floating in Newman's own French. Then I went into the living room to call El Palacio. Wireman answered on the first ring. I was prepared to tell him I'd been outside, looking to see if the storm had done any damage to the house, but my whereabouts at the time of his call were the last thing on Wireman's mind. Wireman was crying and laughing. I can see as well as ever, left eyes as clear as a bell. I can't believe it, but slow down, Wireman, I can barely make you out. He didn't slow down. Maybe he couldn't. A pain went through my bad eye at the height of the storm, pain like you wouldn't believe, like a hot wire. I thought we'd been struck by lightning, so help me God. I tore off the eye patch, and I could see. Do you understand what I'm telling you? I can see. Yes, I said. I understand. That's wonderful. Was it you? It was, wasn't it? I said, maybe, probably. I've got a painting for you. I'll bring it tomorrow. I hesitated. I'd take good care of it, amigo. I don't think it matters what happens to them once they're done, but I also thought Kerry was going to beat Bush. He laughed wildly. Oh, verdad, I heard that. Was it hard? A thought struck me before I could answer. Was the storm hard on Elizabeth? Oh, man, awful. They always scare her, but this one, she was in terror. Screaming about her sisters, Tessie and Lolo, the ones who drowned back in the 1920s. She even had me going for a while there. But it's over now. Are you okay? Was it hard? I looked at the scatterings of sand on the floor between the front door and the stairs. Surely no footprints there. If I thought I was seeing more than sand, that was just my fucking artistic imagination. A little, but it's all over now. I hoped that was true. 21. We talked for another 5 minutes, or rather, Wireman talked, babbled, actually. The last thing he said was that he was afraid to go to sleep. He was afraid he might wake up to discover he was blind in his left eye again.
I told him I didn't think he had to worry about that, wished him a good night, and hung up. What I was worried about was waking up in the middle of the night to discover Tessie and Laura, Lolo to Elizabeth, sitting on either side of my bed, one of them perhaps holding Reba on her damp lap. I took another beer and went back upstairs. I approached the easel with my head down, staring at my feet, then looked up quickly as if hoping to catch the portrait by surprise. Part of me, a rational part, expected to see it defaced by paint splattered from hell to breakfast, a partial wireman obscured by the daubs and blotches I'd thrown at the canvas during the thunderstorm, when my only real light had been lightning. The rest of me knew better. The rest of me knew that I'd been painting by some other light, just as blinded knife throwers use some other sense to guide their hands. That part knew wireman looks west had turned out just fine, and that part was right. In some ways, it was the best work I did on Duma Key, because it was my most rational work. Up until the end, remember, wireman looks west had been done in daylight, and by a man in his right mind. The ghost haunting my canvas had become a sweetheart of a face, young and calm and vulnerable. The hair was a fine, clear black. A little smile lurked at the corners of the mouth, in the green eyes as well. The eyebrows were thick and handsome. The forehead above them was broad, an open window, where this man bent his thoughts toward the Gulf of Mexico. There was no slug in that visible brain. I could just as easily have taken away an aneurysm or a malignant tumor. The cost of finishing the job had been high, but the bill had been paid. The storm had faded to a few faint rumbles somewhere over the Florida panhandle. I thought I could sleep, and I could do it with the bedside lamp on if I wanted to. Reba would never tell. I could even sleep with her nestled in between my stump and my side. I'd done it before. And Wireman could see again, although even that seemed beside the point right then. The point seemed to be that I had finally painted something great, and it was mine. I thought I could sleep on that. How to draw a picture. 6. Keep your focus. It's the difference between a good picture and just one more image cluttering up a world filled with them. Elizabeth Eastlake was a demon when it came to focus. Remember that she literally drew herself back into the world. And when the voice inhabiting Noveen told her about the treasure, she focused on that and drew pictures of it littered on the sandy floor of the gulf. Once the storm had uncovered it, that entrancing strew was close enough to the surface so that the sun must have picked out gleams on it at midday, gleams that would have searched all the way to the surface. She wanted to please her daddy. All she wanted for herself was the China doll. Daddy says, any doll is yours, fair salvage. And God help him for that. She waded in beside him, up to her chubby knees, pointing, saying, it's right out there, swim and kick till I say stop. He waded farther out while she stood there, and when he rolled forward, giving his body to the caldo, his flippers looked to her the size of small rowboats. Later she would draw them just that way. He spat in his mask, rinsed it, and put it on. Popped the mouthpiece of his snorkel behind his lips, went fin-trudging out into the sunny blue with his face in the water, his body merging with the moving sun sparks that turned the glassy rollers to gold. I know all this. Elizabeth drew some, and I drew some. I win, you win. She stood up to her knees in the water with Noveen tucked under her arm, watching until Nan Melda, worried about the rip, hollered her back to what they called Shade Beach. Then they all stood together. Elizabeth shouted for John to stop. They saw his flippers go up as he made his first dive. He was down maybe 40 seconds, then surfaced in a spray, spitting the snorkel's mouthpiece. He says, I'll be damned if there isn't something down there. And when he came back to little Libet, he hugged her, hugged her, hugged her. I knew it. I drew it. With the red picnic basket on a blanket nearby and the spear gun sitting on top of the basket. He went out again, and the next time he came in with an armload of antiquity held awkwardly against his chest. Later he would begin using Nan Melda's market basket, a lead weight in the bottom to pull it down more easily. Later still came a newspaper photo with much of the rescued rickrack, the treasure,
spread out before a smiling John Eastlake and his talented, fiercely focused daughter. But no China doll in that picture. Because the China doll was special. It belonged to Libet. It was her fair salvage. Was it the doll thing that drove Tessie and Lolo to their deaths? That created the big boy? Just how much did Elizabeth have to do with it by then? Who was the artist? Some questions I have never answered to my own satisfaction. But I have drawn my own pictures. And I know that when it comes to art, it's perfectly okay to paraphrase Nietzsche. If you keep your focus, eventually your focus will keep you. Sometimes, without parole. XI. The View from Douma. I. The next morning, early, Wireman and I stood in the gulf, plenty cold enough to be an eye-popper, up to our shins. He had walked in and I had followed without question, without a single word. Both of us were holding coffee cups. He was wearing shorts. I had paused just long enough to roll my pants to my knees. Behind us at the end of the boardwalk, Elizabeth slouched in her chair, looking grimly out at the horizon and grizzling down her chin. A large part of her breakfast still lay before her. She'd eaten some, scattered the rest. Her hair was loose, blowing in a warm breeze from the south. The water surged around us. Once I got used to it, I loved the silky feel of that surge. First the lift that made me feel as if I'd magically dieted off 12 pounds or so. Then the back run that pulled sand out from between my toes in small, tickling whirlpools. 70 or 80 yards beyond us, two fat pelicans drew a line across the morning. Then they folded their wings and dropped like stones. One came up empty, but the other had breakfast in its bill. The small fish disappeared down the hatch, even as the pelican rose. It was an ancient ballet, but no less pleasing for that. South and inland, where the green tangles rose, another bird cried, "Oh, oh, oh, oh," over and over. Wireman turned toward me. He didn't look 25, but he looked younger than at any time since I'd met him. There was no redness at all in his left eye, and it had lost that disjointed, "I'm looking my own way" cast. I had no doubt that it was seeing me, that it was seeing me very well. "Anything I can ever do for you," he said, "ever, in my life. You call, I come. You ask, I do. It's a blank check. Are you clear on that?" "Yes," I said. I was clear on something else as well. When someone offers you a blank check, you must never, ever cash it. That wasn't a thing I thought out. Sometimes understanding bypasses the brain and proceeds directly from the heart. "All right, then," he said. "It's all I'm going to say." I heard snoring. I looked around and saw that Elizabeth's chin had sunk to her chest. One hand was fisted around a piece of toast. Her hair whirled around her head. "She looks thinner," I said. "She's lost 20 pounds since New Year's. I'm slipping her those maxi shakes, Ensure they're called, once a day. But she won't always take 'em. What about you? Is it just too much work that's got you looking that way?" "What way?" "Like the hound of the Baskervilles recently bit off your left ass cheek. If it's overwork, maybe you ought to knock off and stretch out a little." He shrugged. "That's our opinion. We welcome yours, as they say on Channel 6. I stood where I was, feeling the lift and drop of the waves and thinking about what I could tell Wireman, about how much I could tell Wireman. The answer seemed self-evident, all or nothing. "I think I better fill you in on what happened last night. You just have to promise not to call for the men in the white coats." "All right." I told him about how I'd finished his portrait mostly in the dark. I told him about seeing my right arm and hand, then seeing the two dead girls at the foot of the stairs and passing out. By the time I'd finished, we'd waded back out of the water and walked to where Elizabeth was snoring. Wireman began to clear her tray, sweeping the refuse into a bag he took from the pouch hanging on one arm of her chair. "Nothing else?" he asked. "That isn't enough." "I'm just asking." "Nothing else. I slept like a baby until 6 o'clock. Then I put you,
the painting of you, in the back of the car and drove down here. When you're ready to see it, by the way, all in good time, think of a number between 1 and 10.
What?
Just humor me, muchacho.